Allen Jr., of course, was at college. Yale, of course. Oh, yes, he had gone to Yale, too. He had mentioned it often. My son is still a boy, he mused, and yet you, the same age, are every inch a woman. He looked at but did not comment upon the gold band on her hand. You made me a woman. No, darling, you were a woman before I met you. And I wanted you to enjoy, at least once in your life, what it would be like to use that body as it was meant to be used. A woman such as you should be a king's mistress. For a summer, I could give you that experience. So you were a king. He had laughed at that. Oh, Maddie. I know I'm a cad. I'm a terrible person. I tried to tell you that all along. You were beautiful. You wanted me. I was helpless. I'm sure it was some Freudian battle with Alan, a desire to displace him, to assert myself as the patriarch. But I won't apologize for any of it. And you, in your heart of hearts, know you should be thankful. Admit it. Whatever you have now, it's not the same. It's better, she said. Don't lie. I'm not. She wasn't. Look, I'm not saying I have some level of technique in lovemaking that no other man can match, but what we did was sensual. We abandoned ourselves. You can't have that in a marriage. She wanted to prove him wrong. And strangely, illogically, the only way to do that was to go to bed with him. They defiled his marital bed, lying inside of his wife's work, which was, she saw now, exceptional and accomplished. She wished she could afford it. The sex was fun, athletic, but Alan seemed pale and wispy after Milton's comforting bulk. She had vanquished him. The very next night, less than an hour after stepping off the bus, she made love to Milton with a passion and a confidence that so delighted him he suggested she treat herself to more theater trips. 9 months and 2 weeks later, Seth was born. An enormous child, almost 10 pounds. She never doubted he was Milton's. He looked exactly like his father from the minute he emerged. 16 years later, sitting on a bench in downtown Baltimore, she still had no reason to doubt Seth's paternity. Making love with Alan Durst Sr. had not been a mistake that time. She had broken his spell, and that was why she could finally conceive with Milton. Given how easily she had gotten pregnant the summer she was 17, she had expected it to be easy at 20, too. But Seth was to be the first and last pregnancy she carried to term. It was only now, 20 years later, that she saw how close to disaster she had flown, how easily her life could have been upended by their affair and even the one-time coupling in New York. Why had she taken such risks? At least Alan was wrong. Her sensuality was not a fleeting thing, a gift he bestowed on her for one brief season. It had always been hers. It was hers now. If she ever did marry again, when she had the luxury of choosing for herself, she would know that kind of passion in marriage. It had to be possible. She tried never to think about the ghost of a child left behind in the basement office of the doctor that Alan Sr. had found for her the summer she was 17. How her heart felt as if it folded in half when anyone said it was a shame that Seth had to grow up an only child. Milton might have forgiven her for being with another man before marriage. But what happened in that doctor's office when she was 17 would be something he could never accept. Still, she had been punished for her sins, had she not? Only the one son, when she had wanted a house full of children, at least three, at least one daughter. She could have been such a good mother to a daughter. Even good girls make mistakes when they're in love, but they don't deserve to die for them. Maddie had gotten out alive. Cleo Sherwood hadn't. August 1966. She called in sick the next day. Her probationary period was over. She was entitled. She was not sure what would happen if it was discovered that she was not in fact sick, but she didn't worry about getting caught. No one from the Star was going to be lingering on Auchentrolley Terrace, watching to see Mr. Sherwood leave for work, waiting for the coast to clear, she thought, taking her post just before 8 a.m. Her mind picked at the origin of the phrase, jumping to the Longfellow poem about Paul Revere she had memorized as a child. She then thought about Edward R. Murrow's sonorous voice, "This is London," those broadcasts that had led her to the radio club, her decision to join the school newspaper. So many seemingly insignificant moments, yet each one was building toward this life, her real life, at last. "Go look for Tessie Fine," her mother had said. She had, and now she was here, sitting at a bus stop in a Negro neighborhood, conspicuous as... She still couldn't find the right comparison. At any rate, she stood out. She sat on the bus bench on the park side of Auchentrolley Terrace, the sun on her shoulders, marveling at the fact that her mother had gone to school on this very street 60-some years ago, and Milton's family had lived nearby until his father's death in 1964. The only sure thing was time's passing. Shortly after 8:30 a.m., Mr. Sherwood left the apartment. She panicked for a moment. What if he were to walk to this very bus stop? She should have planned for that. Luckily, he headed west. He wore some kind of uniform, a green one-piece. Gas station worker, janitor. She realized she had no idea what he did. Even with Mr. Sherwood out of the apartment, she still didn't want to knock on the door. The children would be there, the boys, possibly Cleo's sister and brothers. Eunetta, she reminded herself, don't call her Cleo. Summer would be over soon. It was almost 8 months since she had left Milton, and they had made little progress in the divorce. She had thought he would accept the inevitability of their marriage's end when she found this job, and it appeared she no longer needed his money. Only, she did need his money. She couldn't live like this forever, scraping by week after week. How long would this drag on? Would it drag on like this summer day, waiting to see if Mrs. Sherwood would leave her apartment? A marriage can drag on forever, she thought. But it's a rare day when a mother with small children doesn't have to leave her home, if only to maintain her sanity. Little boys drink a lot of milk, eat a lot of food. She was right. Slightly before lunchtime, Mrs. Sherwood emerged, headed south. Maddie gave her a head start of a block, then trailed behind her, hanging back when she entered the corner grocery. When she came out holding a single, bulging bag, Maddie was waiting. "Can I help you with that?" she asked. She knew she would be refused, but it seemed nice to ask.
"I'm fine,"
Mrs. Sherwood said, shifting the bag in her arms, shifting her glance to the sidewalk. Maddie fell in step beside her. "Did Eunetta confide in you?"
"I'm not sure what you mean."
Eyes still down as if she were playing the old game, step on a crack, break a mother's back. "Did she tell you she was in love? Did she talk about him?"
"Which time?" "My daughter fell in love a lot, ma'am. Those two boys, my grandsons, that was love, too."
"Too." So she had fallen in love again. Did she talk about him?
"Not with me, no."
"But you must have known. That she was with Ezekiel Taylor. A mother always knows." Maddie did not believe a word of what she was saying. Her mother had never had the slightest inkling about Alan Sr. If she had, well, her family would have found whatever the Jewish equivalent was to a convent and locked Maddie away.
"I'm not a stupid woman, Miss Schwartz. I know what those clothes had in common."
Maddie didn't. Did that make her a stupid woman? He gave them to her.
"They all fit her perfectly. Even though the sizes on the labels didn't match, fit her like a glove."
Maddie thought of the shape of the woman she had seen behind the lace curtain, imploring her, commanding her to leave. Tall, not fat, but broader than slinky Cleo. She wondered if Taylor had gone so far as to pilfer some of his wife's clothes and have them altered to fit Cleo. Was it serious between them?
He has a wife. How serious could it have been? What do you think? My daughter's dead.
That's serious. That's as serious as it gets.
She had managed the trick of falling back a few paces, so she did not appear to be walking with Maddie. Mrs. Sherwood doesn't want to be seen with me, Maddie thought in wonder. Was she afraid word would get back to her husband? Or was Maddie simply an embarrassment? Were there tears in her eyes? Step on a crack, break a mother's heart. She had a block left to get this woman to open up, to trust her, to let her in. Not back into the apartment. She knew she was forever barred from there, but to let her into their lives, let her know the story of Cleo.
Tell me about the last time you saw Eunetta, please. I'm a mother too, I understand.
Mrs. Sherwood sighed, shifting the bag to her hip.
She brought the boys' toys, which made no sense. It wasn't even a week after Christmas, and there she was with two new trucks. She spoiled them so, brought them things, when all they wanted was her. My husband says I spoiled her, but I didn't. She was blazing to do something, be someone. All I tried to do was not get in the way.
Is it possible she knew she was in trouble? That she knew someone wanted her dead? Mrs. Sherwood stumbled on the raised lip between two squares of pavement. Step on a crack.
No, she said. She said she might take a trip, but she'd let me know if she did. When a little time went by and I didn't hear from her, I didn't worry at first. She was careless that way. Then I got to thinking. She gave me a jacket of hers that I always liked. A pause. I said, there's no way that's going to fit me. Your arms are so long. But it fit me. So she'd had it altered just for me, said it was a late Christmas gift.
Mrs. Sherwood, why would someone kill Eunetta?
Doesn't have to be a why, does there? Or if there is a why, it started so long ago before any of us could know or see where things were headed. She wasn't a bad girl, but she spoke her mind. When you are very, very pretty, you start to think you can get away with so much, but I guess you knew that too.
Knew? There was something a little barbed about how quickly Mrs. Sherwood had anointed Maddie with the power of beauty, only to imply it was past. Did you ever meet him, Ezekiel Taylor?
No, there was no reason. I wasn't going to be his mother-in-law, no matter what Eunetta thought. She snorted. That would have been something to have a son-in-law older than me.
So there it was. Ezekiel Taylor was Cleo's boyfriend. Her mother said so, and Cleo had believed he might become her husband. Would that scuttle his political ambitions? No, because as Maddie now knew, it was not considered news if a man running for office had a young girlfriend on the side. But what if the girlfriend would not be silenced? What if she threatened to make a fuss? The status quo relied on women's playing by the rules of a game they could never win. Cleo Sherwood's own mother said the only thing to do when Cleo wanted something was to get out of her way. Could Cleo Sherwood truly have wanted Ezekiel Taylor? Older than her own parents? She might. At the very least, have wanted the life of a rich man's wife. Or a state senator's wife. As they reached the steps of the Sherwood apartment, the sister, Alice, was waiting outside.
Mama, I told you I needed to go to work.
She broke off, stared angrily at Maddie.
What do you want?
Nothing, Maddie said. August 1966. She bided her time. She was serenely, bizarrely confident that the world would provide her the opportunity she needed. She felt full of energy. Even when nights with Ferdy meant she got only 4-5 hours sleep. Pushing back against August's doldrums, she worked harder than ever, wrapping up her work by 3, then dropping by the city desk to tell Cal Weeks she was available if he needed help.
"I'm not authorized to pay you overtime," he told her, ever suspicious.
"Not looking for OT," she said. "Mr. Heath is on vacation for the next 2 weeks and filed his column ahead of time, so there's only so much I can do." He gave her press releases to rewrite. Maddie found that even Cal Weeks had a few things to teach her, such as words to avoid.
"Be careful with terms like first and only, because they're often inaccurate. And the word unique never takes a modifier."
He also had insights into the city around them, who the real players were. And he liked her. Men always did, if Maddie wanted them to. So when she saw that Ezekiel Taylor was going to be opening his 6th dry cleaners on Gwyn Oak Avenue, she offered to cover it.
"I don't know, Maddie. He's one of 8 candidates in the 4th. Might look like favoritism."
She had prepared for his objections. "It's at 4 o'clock today. I skipped lunch, so I'll be off the clock, more or less. What if I go by and see if he makes news, like a policy position or something about Senator Welcome?" Weeks snorted.
"Your time, your dime."
She would not expense the cab she took to Gwyn Oak. Maddie knew the signs that indicated a neighborhood was about to tip from white to black. The newest location of Easy Cleaners was next to a beauty shop in a neighborhood that was just beginning to change. The under contract and sold signs swinging beneath the original for sale signs were covert code for get out now. She couldn't understand why whites in the city didn't want to live next to black people, but they didn't. The mass hysteria over the issue meant that values plummeted rapidly. Was it bigotry to want to live among one's own? The Christian neighborhoods hadn't wanted the Jews. Still didn't, really. The white women walking into Pietro's to get their hair cut and styled would be happy for the convenience of a dry cleaner's in the neighborhood. But they wouldn't want Mr. Taylor as their neighbor. She had arrived in time for the ribbon cutting, which she knew from Cal Weeks could never be considered news. But that was all there was, a ribbon cutting, with a photographer from the Afro dutifully recording it. The Afro had different standards from the city's dailies, apparently. Mr. Taylor had that charisma that some successful men have, a way of making you think that you'd find him attractive even if he weren't successful. Bulky, he moved slowly, spoke slowly and softly, but his eyes were sharp and watchful. Maddie could feel him assessing her quickly as she approached, reporter pad in hand. "Madeline Schwartz from The Star," she said. He smiled, but it was a smile that showed no teeth.
"Glad to know The Star thinks this is news."
"Well, you are running for state senate, although I suppose if you win, you'll leave the dry cleaning business behind."
"Maryland has a part-time legislature, miss, as I'm sure you know. It would be an honor to represent my district, but I still need my job."
She did not, in fact, know that Maryland's legislature was considered a part-time office. It had never occurred to her to think about it. But she did not intend to dwell on politics. She had other topics to discuss with Ezekiel Taylor. "One thing I did want to ask you, did you know a young woman, Eunetta Sherwood?"
"Eunetta?"
His brow furrowed. Most people knew her as Cleo, but her parents preferred her given name, Eunetta. She wanted to remind him that Cleo was someone's daughter. She worked at the Flamingo. You know, Shell Gordon's place over on...
"I am familiar with Mr. Gordon and the Flamingo." The young woman, however.
"After she went missing, her mother found clothing from your dry cleaners in her apartment. Lots of clothing, even a fur."
"Obviously, I don't know all my customers."
"Obviously. But Mrs. Sherwood, Cleo's mother, she told me that Cleo said she was going to marry you one day." There was a split second of hesitation. And then he laughed, and Maddie was impressed. This was not an easy man to rattle.
The stories girls tell their mothers. I am married, Mrs., she said, Schwartz. I do go to the Flamingo when they have musical acts to my liking. I tip well. Who knows what kind of story a young girl could build on top of a little folding money left on a table for a job well done. I'm sure Cleo Sherwood knew who I was. And I'm sure I saw her a time or two behind the bar. Now, if you'll excuse me. He walked to his car with an unhurried, unconcerned gait. Why should he be concerned? He had absolutely checkmated her. Or maybe the better metaphor was poker. Maddie had been so sure of her winning hand that it never occurred to her that she could be bluffed, stonewalled. The men made the rules, broke the rules, and tossed the girls away. What had she expected? That he would sweat and stammer? That he would confess to her that yes, Cleo Sherwood had been killed because she threatened his ambition, his livelihood? She watched a Perry Mason rerun that night, an episode clearly modeled on Oliver Twist. Only the Fagin character, played by Victor Buono, was killed. Mason defended the accused boy, one of the gang members. He sensed something good in him. The next day, Cal Weeks said,
So, no news out of the ribbon cutting?
Nope, Maddie said.
Not even in August could a dog and pony show like that make news.
Who was the dog? Who was the pony? September 1966. Labor Day. Where was I a year ago? Maddie wondered. At the club. The straps of her gingham checked one piece pushed down, burnishing her tan so it might last a few more weeks. Her mother had always said that Maddie shouldn't sunbathe because she tanned too easily. Such an odd idea that anything achieved with ease was to be avoided. But that was Taddy Morgenstern's worldview in a nutshell. This summer, Maddie was not her usual pecan hue, but even if she had been, she would have still seemed pale alongside, beneath Ferdy. She was under him for much of the holiday, not minding the heat, the pooling sweat. They made love until the sheets were slushy, until it felt as if they were underwater. Then they took cool showers together, changed the sheets, ready for a second turn. It was a luxury, having that second set of sheets at the ready. But she had found a cheap laundry on North Liberty Street. She could drop off her linens on the way to work tomorrow. She didn't have to be ashamed in front of the woman who took her bundle of soiled sheets, who spoke no English. Understood, perhaps, but didn't speak. And it was what others said about you that could hurt. Not what they thought. But on this particular night, a holiday, even for lowly clerks and patrolmen, at least this lowly clerk and patrolman, they did not resume making love after the shower. Ferdy pulled her to him, stroked her hair, and murmured the last thing she ever expected him to say.
I think I have a story for you.
A story?
For the newspaper. It's going to happen tomorrow.
How can you know what's going to happen tomorrow?
Because it's happening now, actually. Started to happen. But the guy won't be arraigned until tomorrow. What time is your deadline?
They go all day, right up until 3. Could Ferdy really have a valid tip for her? He had known the inside details about Tessie Fine, after all. But it's best to have it in all editions and update throughout the day.
It's supposed to happen tonight. I got a tip. I mean, the man who told me he didn't realize it was a tip. To him, it was gossip. He likes being in the know. Makes him feel big. He liked telling me about police business, telling me my business to show how plugged in he is. Cock of the walk and all. Didn't occur to him that I know anyone at the papers.
Ferdy, what is it?
As urgent as she felt, she also was sure it would be nothing. An anticlimax. She had been wrong so many times about what might be news. How could Ferdy's judgment be any better?
A man's gonna walk into headquarters tonight and confess to the murder of Cleo Sherwood.
Not an anticlimax. Who?
The bartender from the Flamingo.
The white guy, Spike?
That's the one. Tommy something. It was all made up, everything he told the police. He killed her. He told her he was in love with her. She laughed at him and he killed her. But he can't be arraigned until the courts open back up tomorrow, so he'll be in lockup tonight.
How do I get the story?
If you trust me, you got it. The guy who works overnight at your paper, no one's gonna tell him, right? It's a holiday. They probably got the second string on. This is solid, Maddie. Look, call homicide right now. Tell them you're from the Star, that you have a tip. They'll deny it, but then you say, I'm going with it if you don't tell me I'm wrong. You don't have to confirm or deny it. You don't have to say anything. Reporters do it all the time. A pause. That's what I'm told.
Would that work? It seemed a dangerous game to play. Diller would be angry, being usurped on his beat. But what would it matter if the tip was right? She stared at her phone, scarlet and inert, indifferent to its role in changing her life. What's the number? Ferdy rattled it off, then said,
But don't call from here. Wait another hour. Take a cab to the office, make the call from there. Okay?
She kept the promise to wait, but broke the others, calling from home, not bothering to go to the office. After she hung up with the homicide detective, whose silence confirmed that Thomas Ludlow had arrived without an attorney to confess to the murder of Eunetta Cleo Sherwood, she dialed the city desk and said, as if she had said it 1,000 times before, Cal, this is Maddie Schwartz. Please put me through to rewrite. I've gotten a big break on the Cleo Sherwood story. Cal quizzed her, of course, but she had it cold, and she had won him over, doing all those thankless tasks in the dog days of August. And by 10 o'clock the next morning, most of the city knew it. A white man had killed Cleo Sherwood for the very everyday crime of not loving him. It was not a page one story. And Maddie understood the calculus that determined that. The dead woman was a Negro. She was killed for love, or for lack of love, more accurately. But it was a story good enough for the Metro page, the ending to the tantalizing tale of the Lady in the Lake. Mr. Heath was back from his vacation, and she went about her usual tasks with her usual efficiency, waiting for the moment she would be summoned to the boss's office. She understood and accepted that she would not continue to report the story, that Tommy's arraignment would be covered by someone on courts or cops, that Diller would look for a folo out of the cop shop. That was fine. She didn't want to be a cop reporter. After the final deadline, Bob Bauer stopped by her desk.
Hey, Scoop Schwartz.
She blushed in spite of herself.
So you have sources, huh?
I do.
Who are they?
She hesitated. He leaned in, his voice low and serious.
You don't tell anyone who your sources are.
Not other reporters, not the bosses, not the law, if it comes to that. Whatever you do, protect your sources.
It seemed an odd comment, but she realized that Bob, plugged in as ever, must have known what was coming for her. Because when she was summoned to the city editor's office, not even an hour later, it was not for an attagirl. It was because a furious John Diller wanted her reprimanded for poaching from his beat. 30 minutes later, a shaken but dry-eyed Maddie walked out of the office and into the ladies' room, where she splashed water on her face, then gripped the sink with trembling hands.
You okay?
Asked Edna. Sitting there with her three C's, coffee, cig, and copy.
I think so.
Saw your byline. Nice work.
Diller's pissed, isn't he?
You could say that. He's terrified someone's gonna dethrone him at Cop Shop.
As if anyone wants to be the dean of that bunch. Cop Shop's a place to pass through. No one good stays there.
He wanted me to tell my source. He claims to know who it is. I don't understand why that should matter.
Like I said, he's scared.
The man had appeared more malevolent than scared to Maddie. He had fumed and sputtered like Rumpelstiltskin, on the verge of tearing himself apart.
I know who told you about the confession. That's no source. You risk the paper's integrity trusting him.
Except I was right. Tommy Ludlow did confess. The city editor had treated them like two squabbling schoolchildren.
It was a holiday weekend, John. She had a tip, she ran with it, and it's good. It's not a big deal. It's not the way we do business around here. It was sloppy. It was amateurish. It was...
What are you implying, Mr. Diller? Maddie was investing so much willpower into not crying that her voice screeched a little.
You don't know what you're doing. You got lucky this time, going with a one-source story and that source at that. Stay away from the Cop Shop.
You knew I was trying to write about Cleo Sherwood, and you didn't mind when I filed the story on Lady Law. That was fine by you,
because it was barely a story. It was press release pap.
I'm just trying to become a reporter. Is that so wrong? When Diller left, muttering all the way, the city editor sighed.
It was a good story, Maddie. But I don't want you to pin your hopes on a reporting job. It's a young person's game. If we were to hire a rookie, I'd want it to be someone with a long future ahead of him. Him. Now, in the bathroom, she stared at her own reflection, ashen in the mirror. If Diller really did know the identity of her source, what would that mean for her? For Ferdy? Would he get in trouble? She wished she could call him, be comforted. But she could never call him. She didn't have his number, didn't know where he lived. If she wanted to find Ferdy, her only hope was to head up to Northwest and walk down the street screaming her head off, which was how she had found him 9 months ago. Otherwise, she waited for him to come to her. She decided to take a walk up to the New Orleans diner, grab a coffee before closing. She sat at the counter while the waitress, she remembered from her lunch there with Bob Bauer, leaned on her elbows, reading the newspaper. Reading Maddie's story. I wrote that, she said. Technically untrue, the rewrite, Etlin had written it from her notes, but she couldn't help herself.
So, you're...
The waitress looked from the byline to Maddie, back to the byline.
Madeline Schwartz?
Yes.
I knew her.
Cleo, back at Werner's. She seemed at once shy and excited. Maddie noticed for the first time how young she was, younger than Maddie, with freckles on her nose and the bit of chest she let show in her pink uniform. What was she like? The waitress took so long to answer that Maddie assumed she hadn't been heard. But then,
hungry. She wanted things. She just didn't know what they were.
Tell me about it, Maddie thought. Except she knew what she wanted. She was going to be a reporter, not just any reporter. She was going to be like Bob Bauer one day, a columnist, someone who got to pick and choose her stories. Oh, it wouldn't be the same. It would be harder. And while she could see the goal shining, shimmering, she couldn't see the path. It seemed ridiculous. She had just been told she couldn't even be the night cop reporter, that the paper would never hire her, and yet... She was not unlike Cleo Sherwood. If she really wanted something, she got it. She had wanted Alan Durst, had seduced him as much as he had seduced her. She had wanted Milton. The cloak of respectability, he promised, when Durst left her, deflowered and almost ruined. She had wanted to have a child. Then she had wanted her freedom. 37 might have been old or late to do such things, but it was not impossible. After all, there was, well, Grandma Moses. Oh, Lord, there must be someone other than Grandma Moses. When she returned to the newsroom, the fifth floor had that extra charge. Unusual with the final deadline passed. What's happening? She asked one of the copy boys. Shooting at the courthouse, he said, at the arraignment for that guy who confessed to the lady in the lake killing. She had used that phrase this morning in her story, and now here it was, set, immortalized. Maddie had sincerely forgotten that she had stolen it from the medical examiner. What happened? Guy took a shot at him when they took him out of the wagon at the side entrance. Is he dead? She felt a weird throb of sympathy for the man who had walked her to her car, had compared Cleo Sherwood to a poem. Then she remembered he had killed her. In surgery at Mercy, no condition report yet. And who shot him? Cleo Sherwood's father. Maddie didn't even bother to ask. She grabbed a notebook and went to Auchentrolley Terrace. There, a stunned Mrs. Sherwood led her inside, sobbing. In the span of less than 12 hours, she had seen her daughter's death resolved, only to have her husband make this ill-conceived stab at vengeance. Her daughter was dead, and now her husband was going to be in jail, possibly for murder. Maddie approached Cal Weeks about 8 p.m., knowing he would have eaten dinner by then. Has anyone talked to the mother?
The who?
Merva Sherwood. She was the mother of Cleo Sherwood. Cal looked confused. Her husband, Cleo's father, was arrested for trying to shoot Cleo's killer today, she added. Her parents preferred to call her by her given name, Yunetta.
No one was home by the time a reporter got there. They're probably in hiding at a relative's.
I talked to her. I had been to the apartment before on my own time. I was so interested in Cleo's death, I just kept thinking there had to be an answer, and now, I guess there is.
Did you take notes?
Yes.
Feed him to rewrite.
But I'm right here, and the first deadline isn't until—
Feed him to rewrite. Don't worry, you'll get a trip line.
I'm not worried about that. I told her mother I would write the story. If you want my notes, you have to let me write it. While she could not put everything she knew about Cleo Sherwood in the paper, she could tell the story of her mother, of a woman who had lost a daughter and would now lose a husband, a woman who had a closet full of beautiful clothes and had no idea how her child had come to own them. She could tell about the psychic, the still baffling visions of green and yellow, the waitress who knew her back at Werner's. They had to cut quite a bit.
It's only a sidebar, for Christ's sake.
But she fought to keep the detail about all those altered clothes hung on the paper-shrouded wire hangers from Easy Cleaners. She wanted Ezekiel Taylor to know that someone knew his secrets. September 1966. No matter how hot the weather, and it was very hot in 1966, September will always be the beginning of fall, and fall will always be the true start of the year. Maddie's mother assumed her prodigal daughter would return to the Morgenstern household for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Maddie remembered Riley, how she had struggled for years to wrest the holiday dinners from her mother, how insistent she had been on creating her own traditions, how she had scandalized her mother with her recipe for haroset at last year's Passover, made with figs and dates. It all seemed so trivial now. The primary fell 2 days before Rosh Hashanah, and Maddie volunteered to take results. It was an inglorious job, but no more inglorious than the job she continued to do every day, despite her scoop on the Sherwood story. She typed the vote tallies in the city legislative districts, her swift fingers stopping for a second when it came time to enter the numbers for the Senate seat in the 4th District. A newcomer, Clarence Mitchell III,
was the top vote getter, but Verda Welcome was second. Ezekiel Taylor was a distant fourth. How silly she had been to think that any of this had anything to do with Cleo. Hindsight, they called it. Well, in hindsight, Maddie saw the world for what it was, where women belonged in it. Men were entitled to have their girls on the side, as long as they were discreet. Men, some men, felt entitled to kill the women who did not return their affections. Cleo Sherwood did not matter enough. She could not have swayed this election. She had never mattered at all. Here was Ezekiel Taylor, his reputation intact, his campaign underwritten by Shell Gordon's dirty money. How silly Maddie had been. Cleo's death had been more interesting as a mystery. Solved, it was dull. Her father's crazed, desperate act outside the courthouse had drawn more attention than his daughter's murder. It was one thing for a white man to kill a Negro woman, crazed with love for her, but for that woman's father to start shooting outside the courthouse, in a crowd, grazing a young police officer, he was expected to spend as long in prison as his daughter's killer, if not longer. Maddie became aware, as she kept taking calls and updating numbers, of a sensation sweeping through the newsroom. There was a surprise, something unexpected in the results. Even jaded Edna, here to write a color story on whatever patterns emerged from the statewide races, looked caught off guard. "What's up?" Maddie asked Bob Bauer, who had just pulled his column from his typewriter. But instead of calling copy, he crumpled it and inserted a fresh sheet. "Damn thing's too close to call. With all the precincts in, Mahoney's got the lead by less than 150 votes. There's going to be a recount. Clarence Mitchell III is already saying he'll organize Negroes for Agnew if Mahoney is the candidate." How could Mahoney win? Maddie had followed the governor's race in the papers all summer. Mahoney was a six-time loser in state politics. Sickles and Finan split the base, and Mahoney had a message that resonated: your home is your castle. But wasn't that racist? Maybe to you. To some guy who's watching the value of his home plummet because his neighborhood is changing, it's different. You can't mess with a man's home, it defines him. He looked at the paper in his typewriter. That's it. That's it, you can't mess with a man's home. I've got my lead, Maddie. So, if you'll excuse me. It rained all day the next day. It rained almost 4 inches, a record. It was not a cleansing rain, the kind that left a city refreshed. Humidity lingered, and Maddie's straightened hair seemed to shrink as her natural ways returned. Everyone at the paper was tired and cranky, working on too little sleep and too much coffee. On Thursday, she went to her mother's house, carrying a dish of homemade chicken liver with pistachios. "Is this from Seven Locks?" her mother asked. "Actually, I made it myself." She had a laborious job that involved pushing the chicken livers through a sieve. "It's kosher." Her father picked the nuts out. "They're bad for my bowels," he said. But her mother's inability to criticize the dish was a kind of validation. Unfortunately, it also freed her to move on to Maddie's personal life. She began, "Yom Kippur is coming." "Of course." "So? Are you going to go back home?" "If you ask Milton to take you back, he would probably consider it. After all, part of atoning is to forgive others. I have nothing to atone for," Maddie said sharply, "and nothing for which I need to be forgiven."
"Are you dating?"
There was something sly about her mother's question, a hint of things unsaid. But Maddie's mother had no way of knowing what happened at the corner of Mulberry and Cathedral. "No." It wasn't a lie. Maddie reasoned it wasn't a date if all you did was have sex in your own apartment. She thought about the night at the ballpark. How thrilling it was simply to sit by him, shoulder to shoulder. Then she thought about John Diller, eyes narrowed, saying, "That source." Her mother said, "Really, Maddie? I understand, believe me. The summer before your senior year in high school, I went a little crazy. It's natural. You spend your life raising a child, then it's time for the child to move on. It happens to every woman I know. Debbie Wasserman got caught shoplifting at the Giant over on Ingleside. She drove all the way over there to steal a Sara Lee swirl cake." Maddie slathered some chicken liver on a piece of toast. It really was excellent. She was a better cook in her galley kitchen with the two-burner stove than she had been in Pikesville, with a freezer full of Hutzler's cheese bread and all her little tricks for making dinner parties seem homey and homemade. "I don't think that's my situation. I have a brain. It almost atrophied from lack of use, and now I want to use it." "At a newspaper? And the Star, of all places?" The Morgenstern household took the Beacon in the morning, the Light in the afternoon, and was suspicious of those who didn't follow suit. Her mother had never even seen Maddie's work. "Look, I'm just telling you, Madeline. I know." Her mother leveled her gaze at Maddie. And suddenly she was 16 again, but only for a moment. She wondered what her mother did know. Did she suspect that Maddie was not a virgin before she married? That she had visited an abortionist on Lower Park Heights? It seemed impossible that she would figure out that Maddie had sought Alan out, made love to him again, then come home and conceived a child with Milton. More impossible still that she could have heard any whispers about Maddie and Ferdy. How silly their names sounded together, she realized. And yet how right. And if Diller knew about them, well, so what? It wasn't as if her mother was going to run into the Star's cop reporter, or even his wife at the Seven Locks Market. "You could be home by October 1st, her mother said now. "Every marriage has its bumps." She glanced at her husband, who had made a neat pile of pistachios on his plate. He had been chosen for her, Taddy's parents designating him as the only acceptable suitor for their oldest daughter. Not that different from a Shidduch or the Fiddler on the Roof days. Her mother's German Jew parents would be horrified by such a comparison, even in the privacy of Maddie's mind. But it was apt enough. Her father wasn't even first generation. He had been born on the boat en route to the United States. 1906, 60 years ago. How could 1906 and 1966 be part of the same century? In 1906, there had been no world wars. Most people didn't have telephones and cars. In 1906, women couldn't vote and black men could by law, but not in practice. Her parents seemed impossibly distant from her. She seemed distant from herself. Maddie couldn't believe that she was related to the woman who used to sit in this same chair, eating this same Rosh Hashanah meal, minus her fancy chopped liver. She felt a chill, almost as if a ghost passed through her. But it was the ghost of who she used to be. Forget 1906 and 1966. Maddie couldn't believe that 1965 and 1966 were part of the same century. She was different. Couldn't her mother see how different she was? A week later, on Yom Kippur, she didn't attend synagogue, although she fasted until sundown out of habit. She then ordered too much food at Paul Cheng's with Seth, taking home the leftovers, confident that Ferdy would drop by. He did. October 1966.
When's your birthday?
Ferdy and Maddie were in a tangle of limbs, enjoying that first truly chilly night of fall, the night when quilts return to the bed and one leaves the window open a scant 2 inches. Even here, above the traffic and dirt of Mulberry Street, the air smelled fresh and new. Why do you ask?
Why wouldn't I ask? We've been seeing each other almost a year, and you haven't had a birthday yet, not that I know of.
Only 9 months, Maddie said.
That's almost a year, isn't it?
Amused, but also with a tinge of hurt, as if she were downplaying whatever they had. November, she said, November 10th.
And you'll be 38.
Her turn to be hurt. She didn't think she looked her age. Ferdy must have realized his gaffe because he said,
I asked for your driver's license the day we met. I remembered the year, but not the date. What do you want for your birthday?
Oh, I don't need a gift.
Maybe I need to give you one. Have you ever thought about that?
It was almost instinctive, almost. To begin kissing him, to move her body down the length of his, past that lean torso, that knot of a belly button, down, down, down. It was only later that Maddie realized how many times she had done just this to avoid certain conversations. When Ferdy said anything that sounded romantic, partner-like, she distracted him with sex. Distracted herself, too. She liked pleasing him, because he always pleased her back. Her pleasure had seemed secondary to the other men she had known. Sometimes she enjoyed it, sometimes she faked it, and Milton couldn't tell the difference. Alan had loved seduction, the buildup. She wondered now, for the first time, if Alan preferred taking virgins because they had nothing to which to compare the experience. As someone's first lover, one is inevitably the best. 38 is such a stupid age. She said later, it's not 40, yet it's not not 40. A beat. How old are you? When is your birthday?
December, December 25th.
He didn't give his age, though. Ah, so you probably never have much of a birthday. But December 25th means nothing to me. We can do what the Jews do, eat Chinese food. She didn't add, and go to a movie, although a matinee, then Chinese food, had been the tradition in the Schwartz household.
In bed.
He seemed glum. That's the old joke, take your fortune cookie, read the fortune, and add the words in bed. It always works. He didn't laugh. We can do whatever you like on your birthday.
I would like.
Her heart almost stopped, terrified that he would ask for something she could never give him. Instead, he buried his face between her breasts, but he wasn't trying to distract her.
I would like to give you the world, Maddie.
I don't need the world, she said. You've given me more than I could ever imagine. With that, she slipped on a robe and went to fix a tray. The second feature on Channel 2 was Devil's Harbor, some kind of a crime film, while the midnight movie on 11 was Her Master's Voice, which seemed to be a comedy, mismatched lovers, Shakespeare's favorite story, but executed at a much lower level. Maddie let Ferdy choose, and was surprised when he picked the comedy, already 30 minutes in. She would be exhausted at work tomorrow, keeping such late hours, but who cared? She didn't need to be fresh to open mail, answer phones, and fetch Mr. Helpline's lunch.
I'm gonna get you the best gift, Ferdy said suddenly, his hand on her thigh.
She thought he wanted to make love again, but he continued to watch the movie. At some point, she fell asleep, and when her alarm sounded at 6:30, only the tray with the empty plate and two drained glasses prove that he had ever been there. October, 1966. Milton wanted to meet. For lunch, he said, making the phone call himself instead of relying on Seth to transmit the message. Just the two of them, he said. He suggested Danny's, an old favorite, and Maddie had to explain that she had an hour for lunch at most, and she almost always ate at her desk. By the time she made her way to Danny's, she'd have only enough time to order a drink, bolt it, and return to work.
Dinner, then? Tio Pepe's?
No, that was too grand. She countered with Maison Marconi's, within walking distance of her apartment. She would have time to get home, change, and meet him there for dinner at a very respectable 6:30. Plus, although the food was delicious, Marconi's was overlit. Not the least bit romantic. Still, the request worried her. There had been phone calls before, some angry, some benign, some both, but they had not been alone, face to face, since January. He had continued to send a little money to her, but never on a predictable schedule, and never the same amount twice. Seth would hand her an envelope of cash at their weekly meetings.
To cover dinner, Dad says.
Inside would be far more money than required by dinner at the suburban house or Paul Cheng's Cantonese, but also less than her monthly rent. An odd gesture, one that could be seen as hostile or well-intentioned. Maddie had decided to take the more generous view. She had broken the man's heart. And for what? It probably would have been much easier on Milton if she had left him for a richer, more successful man. Say, Wallace Wright. If she had left him for anyone or anything tangible. From where he sat, it must have seemed insulting for his wife to leave only to work as a newspaper clerk, one with little hope of advancement. She had not had a byline proper since the story on the Sherwoods. Her achievements kept being written off as flukes, feats she could not repeat. He had never seen her apartment, of course, but he must have had some inkling of it. The whole thing could have fit into their living room in Pikesville. Yes, how baffling this whole adventure must have been to Milton. How baffling it was to Maddie. She dressed carefully, trying to find a middle ground between her old and new selves. One of her longer dresses, slightly below the knee. High heels instead of the boots she now preferred. She put her hair up, back combing it just a little. Her only jewelry was a pin she had found in a secondhand store in Fells Point, a cursive M of sterling silver. She wondered often about the woman who had given it up, what her M had stood for. She remembered how delighted she had been to realize, upon marriage, that her monogram would be two small M's, Madeline Morgenstern, on either side of an S for Schwartz. It was so beautifully symmetrical, those two M's bracketing the S. How she had doted on the embroidered pieces of her trousseau. But now it seemed to her that those two M's, dwarfed by the S, had predicted all too well what her life would be. A handmaiden first to Milton, then to Seth. She applied a pale lipstick, one of the newer shades. In the bright lights of Marconi's, Milton looked nervous. Oh dear. He leaned in, seemingly to kiss her on the cheek, then apparently thought better of it and offered her a comically firm handshake. Hail, fellow, well met. They talked about Seth until the chopped salad arrived, then about work, Milton's, not Maddie's, while they waited for their entrees. Dover sole for Milton, sweetbreads for Maddie. She really wanted the lobster cardinal, but felt it would be gauche to order the most expensive thing on the menu. And she still held on to the habit of not eating shellfish in front of observant Milton. The conversation was pleasant, but throughout there was a sense that Milton was postponing what he really wanted to say. Over the ice cream with the famous chocolate sauce, he blurted out, "You don't wear your rings anymore." She had almost forgotten the story. They were stolen. From the first apartment, that's part of the reason I moved.
I'm not sure you picked a safer part of town.
I live not even two blocks from here. If it's safe enough to drive down for dinner, how bad can it be? She regretted telling him that her apartment was nearby. He would probably insist on taking her to her door. What if he tried to kiss her? She had loved Milton, she really had. If it hadn't been for Wally Weiss, she might never have realized she had fallen out of love with him. She remembered fondly his broad, fuzzy chest, how safe she had felt with him. She didn't need to feel safe anymore.
I'm sorry, I haven't done anything about the divorce. But it's almost a year now. I've been advised I can file on grounds of abandonment.
Strangely, she almost wanted to defend herself. Abandonment. She hadn't abandoned anyone. She had been saving her own life. Would I receive alimony?
Do you need it?
Ah. That question hurt because the answer was yes, she did. But she could not bring herself to say that. I'm merely curious about how the law works in general. We were together almost 20 years.
I'll probably sell the house. Seth wants to go to Penn.
A non sequitur. Or was it? There's money enough for that, isn't there, without selling the house?
Money's not the issue. Maddie, I've met someone.
Of course. Of course. And she doesn't want to live in my house.
She hasn't said as much, but with Seth going away, she's quite young.
What's young?
25.
Of course. So I'm not quite old enough to be her mother, but you could have been her father.